In the evening, the awning was rolled up. The parrot squawking in its cage, and the small tables were surrounded by men in their shirt sleeves. When Kotar entered, one man, with a white shirt gaping on a brick-red chest and a straw hat planted well back on his head, rose to his feet. He had a sun-tanned face, regular features, small black eyes, very white teeth, and two or three rings on his fingers. He looked about 30.
"Hi," he said to Kotar, ignoring Rombert. "Let's have one at the bar."
They drank three rounds in silence.
"How about a stroll?" Garcia suggested.
They walked toward the harbor. Garcia asked what he was wanted to do. Kotar explained that it wasn't really for a deal that he wanted to introduce his friend, Monsieur Rombert, but only for what he called a getaway. Puffing at his cigarette, Garcia walked straight ahead. He asked some questions, always referring to Rombert as he, and appearing not to notice his presence.
"Why does he want to go?"
"His wife is in France."
"Ah."
After a short pause, he added, "What's his job?"
"He's a journalist."
"Is he now?
Journalists have long tongues."
"I told you, he's a friend of mine," Kotar replied.
They walked on in silence until they were near the wharves, which were now railed off. Then they turned in the direction of a small tavern from which came a smell of fried sardines.
"In any case," Garcia said finally, "it's not up my alley. Raoul's your man, and I'll have to get in touch with him. It's none too easy."
"That's so?"
Kotar sounded interested.
"He's lying low, is he?"
Garcia made no answer. At the door of the tavern he halted and for the first time addressed Rombert directly. "The day after tomorrow at 11, at the corner of the customs barracks in the upper town." He made as if to go, then seemed to have an afterthought. "It's going to cost something, you know." He made the observation in a quite casual tone. Rombert nodded.
"Naturally."
On the way back, the journalist thanked Kotar.
"Don't mention it, old chap. I'm only too glad to help you.
And then, you're a journalist. I dare say you'll put in a word for me one day or another."
2 days later, Rombert and Kotar climbed the wide, shadeless street leading to the upper part of the town. The barracks occupied by the customs officers had been partly transformed into a hospital, and a number of people were standing outside the main entrance, some of them hoping to be allowed to visit a patient. A futile hope, since such visits were strictly prohibited, and others to glean some news of an invalid, news that in the course of an hour would have ceased to count. For these reasons, there were always a number of people and a certain amount of movement at this spot, a fact that probably accounted for its choice by Garcia for his meeting with Rombert.
"It puzzles me," Kotar remarked, "why you're so keen on going. Really, what's happening here is extremely interesting."
"Not to me," Rombert replied.
"Well, yes, one's running some risks, I grant you."
"All the same, when you come to think of it, one ran quite as much risk in the old days, crossing a busy street." Just then, Ryu's car drew up level with them. Taru was at the wheel, and Ryu seemed half asleep. He roused himself to make the introductions.
"We know each other," Taru said. "We're at the same hotel."
He then offered to drive Rombert back to the center.
"No, thanks. We've an appointment here."
Ryu looked hard at Rombert.
"Yes," Rombert said.
"What's that?" Kotar sounded surprised. "The doctor knows about it?"
"There's the magistrate."
Taru gave Kotar a warning glance. Kotar's look changed. Monsieur Othon was striding down the street toward them, briskly, yet with dignity. He took off his hat as he came up with them.
"Good morning, Monsieur Othon," said Taru.
The magistrate returned the greeting of the man in the car and, turning to Rombert and Kotar, who were in the background, gave them a quiet nod. Taru introduced Kotar and the journalist. The magistrate gazed at the sky for a moment, sighed, and remarked that these were indeed sad times.
I've been told, Monsieur Theroux, he continued, that you are helping to enforce the prophylactic measures. I need hardly say how commendable that is. A fine example. Do you think, Dr. Ryu, that the epidemic will get worse? Ryu replied that one could only hope it wouldn't. And the magistrate replied that one must never lose hope. The ways of Providence were inscrutable. Theroux asked if his work had increased as the result of present conditions. Quite the contrary. Criminal cases of what we call the first instance are growing rarer. In fact, almost my only work just now is holding inquiries into more serious breaches of the new regulations. Our ordinary laws have never been so well respected. That's because, by contrast, they necessarily appear good ones, Theroux observed. The magistrate, who seemed unable to take his gaze off the sky, abruptly dropped his mildly meditative air and stared at Theroux. What does that matter? It's not the law that counts, it's the sentence. And that's something we must all accept. That fellow, said Theroux when the magistrate was out of hearing, is enemy number one. He pressed the starter. Some minutes later, Rombert and Cottard saw Garcia approaching. Without making any sign of recognition, he came straight up to them and, by way of greeting, said, You'll have to wait a bit. There was complete silence in the crowd around them, most of whom were women. Nearly all were carrying parcels. They had the vain hope of somehow smuggling these in to their sick relatives, and the even crazier idea that the latter could eat the food they'd brought. The gate was guarded by armed sentries, and now and then an eerie cry resounded in the courtyard between the barrack rooms and the entrance. Whenever this happened, anxious eyes turned toward the sick wards. The three men were watching the scene when a brisk, "Good morning," from behind them made them swing round. In spite of the heat, Raoul was wearing a well-cut dark suit and a felt hat with rolled-up brim. He was tall and strongly built, his face rather pale. Hardly moving his lips, he said quickly and clearly, "Let's walk down to the center. You, Garcia, needn't come." Garcia lit a cigarette and remained there while they walked away. Placing himself between Rombert and Cottard, Raoul set the pace, a fast one. "Garcia's explained the situation," he said. "We can fix it, but I must warn you it'll cost you a cool 10,000. Rombert said he agreed to these terms. "Lunch with me tomorrow at the Spanish restaurant near the docks." Rombert said, "Right," and Raoul shook his hand, smiling for the first time. After he had gone, Cottard said he wouldn't be able to come to lunch next day, as he had an engagement. But anyhow, Rombert didn't need him anymore. When next day Rombert entered the Spanish restaurant, everyone turned and stared at him. The dark, cellar-like room below the level of the small yellow street was patronized only by men, mostly Spaniards, judging by their looks. Raoul was sitting at a table at the back of the room. Once he had beckoned to the journalist, and Rombert started to go toward him, the curiosity left the faces of others, and they bent over their plates again. Raoul had beside him a tall, thin, ill-shaven man, with enormously wide shoulders, an equine face, and thinning hair. His shirt sleeves were rolled up, displaying long, skinny arms covered with black hair. When Rombert was introduced, he gave three slow nods. His own name, however, wasn't announced, and Raoul, when referring to him, always said, "Our friend." "Our friend here thinks he may be able to help you." "He's going," Raoul broke off, as the waitress had just come to take Rombert's order. "He's going to put you in touch with two of our friends, who'll introduce you to some sentries whom we've squared. But that doesn't mean you can start right away. You'll have to leave it to the sentries to decide on the best moment. The simplest thing will be for you to stay some nights with one of them. His home is quite near the gate. The first thing is for our friend here to give you the contacts needed. Then, when everything's set, you'll settle with him for the expenses."
Again, the friend slowly moved his equine head up and down, without ceasing to munch the tomato and pimento salad he was shoveling into his mouth. After which he began to speak with a slight Spanish accent. He asked Rombert to meet him, the next day but one, at 8 in the morning in the cathedral porch. Another 2 days' wait, Rombert observed.
It ain't so easy as all that, you see, Raoul said. Them boys take some finding.
Horseface nodded slow approval once more. Some time was spent looking for a subject of conversation. The problem was solved easily enough when Rombert discovered that Horseface was an ardent football player. He, too, had been very keen on soccer. They discussed the French championship, the merits of professional English teams, and the technique of passing. By the end of the meal, Horseface was in high good humor, was calling Rombert old boy, and trying to convince him that the most sporting position by far in the football field was that of center half.
You see, old boy, it's the center half that does the placing. And that's the whole art of the game, isn't it?
Rombert was inclined to agree, though he personally had always played center forward. The discussion proceeded peacefully until a radio was turned on, and after first emitting a series of sentimental songs, broke into the announcement that there had been 137 plague deaths on the previous day. No one present betrayed the least emotion. Horseface merely shrugged and stood up. Raoul and Rombert followed his example. As they were going out, the center half shook Rombert's hand vigorously.
My name's Gonzalez, he said.
To Rombert, the next 2 days seemed endless. He looked up Rieu and described to him the latest developments, then accompanied the doctor on one of his calls. He took leave of him on the doorstep of a house where a patient, suspected to have plague, was awaiting him. There was a sound of footsteps and voices in the hall. The family were being warned of the doctor's visit.
I hope Taru will be on time,
Rieu murmured. He looked worn out.
Is the epidemic getting out of hand? Rombert asked.
Rieu said it wasn't that. Indeed, the death graph was rising less steeply. Only they lacked adequate means of coping with the disease. We're short of equipment. In all the armies of the world, a shortage of equipment is usually compensated for by manpower. But we're short of manpower, too. Haven't doctors and trained assistants been sent from other towns?
Yes, Rieu said.
10 doctors and 100 helpers. That sounds a lot, no doubt, but it's barely enough to cope with the present state of affairs. And it'll be quite inadequate if things get worse. Rombert, who had been listening to the sounds within the house, turned to Rieu with a friendly smile.
Yes, he said. You'd better make haste to win your battle.
Then a shadow crossed his face.
You know, he added in a low tone, it's not because of that I'm leaving.
Rieu replied that he knew it very well, but Rombert went on to say, I don't think I'm a coward, not as a rule anyhow, and I've had opportunities of putting it to the test. Only there are some thoughts I simply can't endure. The doctor looked him in the eyes.
You'll see her again, he said.
Maybe. But I just can't stomach the thought that it may last on. And all the time she'll be growing older. At 30, one's beginning to age, and one's got to squeeze all one can out of life. But I doubt if you can understand.
Rieu was replying that he thought he could, when Taru came up, obviously much excited.
I've just asked Panlu to join us.
Well? Asked the doctor.
He thought it over, then said yes.
That's good, the doctor said. I'm glad to know he's better than a sermon.
Most people are like that, Taru replied. It's only a matter of giving them the chance.
He smiled and winked at Rieu.
That's my job in life, giving people chances.
Excuse me, Rombert said. I've got to be off.
On Thursday, the day of the appointment, Rombert entered the cathedral porch at 8:05. The air was still relatively cool. Small fleecy clouds, which presently the sun would swallow at a gulp, were drifting across the sky. A faint smell of moisture rose from the lawns, parched though they were. Still masked by the eastward houses, The sun was warming up Joan of Arc's helmet only, and it made a solitary patch of brightness in the cathedral square. A clock struck 8. Rombert took some steps in the empty porch. From inside came a low sound of intoning voices, together with stale wafts of incense and dank air. Then the voices ceased. 10 small black forms came out of the building and hastened away toward the center of the town. Rombert grew impatient. Other black forms climbed the steps and entered the porch. He was about to light a cigarette when it struck him that smoking might be frowned on here. At 8:15, the organ began to play, very softly. Rombert entered. At first, he could see nothing in the dim light of the aisle. After a moment, he made out in the nave the small black forms that had preceded him. They were all grouped in a corner, in front of a makeshift altar in which stood a statue of Saint Roch, carved in haste by one of our local sculptors. Kneeling, they looked even smaller than before, blobs of clotted darkness hardly more opaque than the gray, smoky haze in which they seemed to float. Above them, the organ was playing endless variations. When Rombert stepped out of the cathedral, he saw Gonzales already going down the steps on his way back to the town. "I thought you'd cleared off, old boy," he said to the journalist, "considering how late it is." He proceeded to explain that he'd gone to meet his friends at the place agreed on, which was quite nearby, at 7:50, the time they'd fixed, and waited 20 minutes without seeing them. "Something must have held them up. There's lots of snags, you know, in our line of business." He suggested another meeting at the same time on the following day, beside the war memorial. Rombert sighed and pushed his hat back on his head. "Don't take it so hard," Gonzales laughed. "Why, think of all the swerves and runs and passes you gotta make to score a goal." "Quite so," Rombert agreed. "But the game lasts only an hour and a half." The war memorial at Oran stands at the one place where one has a glimpse of the sea, a sort of esplanade following for a short distance the brow of the cliff overlooking the harbor. Next day, being again the first to arrive at the meeting place, Rombert whiled away the time reading the list of names of those who had died for their country. Some minutes later, 2 men strolled up, gave him a casual glance, then, resting their elbows on the parapet of the esplanade, gazed down intently at the empty, lifeless harbor. Both wore short-sleeved jerseys and blue trousers, and were of much the same height. The journalist moved away and, seated on a stone bench, studied their appearance at leisure. They were obviously youngsters, not more than 20. Just then he saw Gonzales coming up. "Those are our friends," he said, after apologizing for being late. Then he led Rombert to the 2 youths, whom he introduced as Marcel and Louis. They looked so much alike that Rombert had no doubt they were brothers. "Right," said Gonzales. "Now you know each other, you can get down to business." Marcel, or Louis, said that their turn of guard duty began in 2 days and lasted a week. They'd have to watch out for the night when there was the best chance of bringing it off. The trouble was that there were 2 other sentries, regular soldiers, besides themselves at the west gate. These 2 men had better be kept out of the business. One couldn't depend on them. And anyhow, it would pile up expenses unnecessarily. Some evenings, however, these 2 sentries spent several hours in the back room of a nearby bar. Marcel, or Louis, said that the best thing Rombert could do would be to stay at their place, which was only a few minutes' walk from the gate, and wait till one of them came to tell him the coast was clear. It should then be quite easy for him to make his getaway. But there was no time to lose. There had been talk about setting up duplicate sentry posts a little farther out. Rombert agreed and handed some of his few remaining cigarettes to the young men. The one who had not yet spoken asked Gonzales if the question of expenses had been settled, and whether an advance would be given. "No," Gonzales said. "And you needn't bother about that. He's a pal of mine. He'll pay when he leaves." Another meeting was arranged. Gonzales suggested their dining together on the next day but 1, at the Spanish restaurant.
It was an easy walking distance from where the young men lived.
For the first night, he added, I'll keep you company, old boy.
Next day, on his way to his bedroom, Rombert met Tarou coming down the stairs at the hotel.
Like to come with me? He asked. I'm just off to see Rieu.
Rombert hesitated.
Well, I never feel sure I'm not disturbing him.
I don't think you need worry about that. He's talked about you quite a lot.
The journalist pondered.
Then, look here, he said. If you've any time to spare after dinner, never mind how late, why not come to the hotel, both of you, and have a drink with me?
That'll depend on Rieu.
Tarou sounded doubtful.
And on the plague, said Tarou.
At 11 o'clock that night, however, Rieu and Tarou entered the small, narrow bar of the hotel. Some 30 people were crowded into it, all talking at the top of their voices. Coming from the silence of the plague-bound town, the two newcomers were startled by the sudden burst of noise and halted in the doorway. They understood the reason for it when they saw that liquor was still to be had here. Rombert, who was perched on a stool at a corner of the bar, beckoned to them. With complete coolness, he elbowed away a noisy customer beside him to make room for his friends.
You've no objection to a spot of something strong?
No, Tarou replied.
Quite the contrary.
Rieu sniffed the pungency of bitter herbs in the drink that Rombert handed him. It was hard to make oneself heard in the din of voices, but Rombert seemed chiefly concerned with drinking. The doctor couldn't make up his mind whether he was drunk yet. At one of the two tables that occupied all the remaining space beyond the half-circle round the bar, a naval officer, with a girl on each side of him, was describing to a fat, red-faced man a typhus epidemic at Cairo.
They had camps, you know, he was saying,
for the natives, with tents for the sick ones and a ring of sentries all round. If a member of the family came along and tried to smuggle in one of those damn fool native remedies, they fired at sight. A bit tough, I grant you, but it was the only thing to do. At the other table, round which sat a bevy of bright young people, the talk was incomprehensible, half drowned by the stridents of St. James Infirmary, coming from a loudspeaker just above their heads.
Any luck? Rieu had to raise his voice. I'm getting on, Rombert replied. In the course of the week, perhaps.
A pity, Tarou shouted.
Why?
Oh, Rieu put in. Tarou said that because he thinks you might be useful to us here.
But personally, I understand you wish to get away only too well.
Tarou stood the next round of drinks. Rombert got off his stool and looked him in the eyes for the first time.
How could I be useful?
Why, of course, Tarou replied, slowly reaching toward his glass.
In one of our sanitary squads.
The look of brooding obstinacy that Rombert so often had came back to his face, and he climbed again onto his stool.
Don't you think these squads of ours do any good? Asked Tarou,
who had just taken a sip of his glass and was gazing hard at Rombert.
I'm sure they do, the journalist replied, and drank off his glass.
Rieu noticed that his hand was shaking, and he decided definitely that the man was far gone in drink. Next day, when for the second time Rombert entered the Spanish restaurant, he had to make his way through a group of men who had taken chairs out on the sidewalk and were sitting in the green-gold evening light, enjoying the first breaths of cooler air. They were smoking an acrid-smelling tobacco. The restaurant itself was almost empty. Rombert went to the table at the back at which Gonzalez had sat when they met for the first time. He told the waitress he would wait a bit. It was 7:30. In twos and threes, the men from outside began to dribble in and seat themselves at the tables. The waitresses started serving them, and a tinkle of knives and forks, a hum of conversation, began to fill the cellar-like room. At 8, Rombert was still waiting. The lights were turned on. A new set of people took the other chairs at his table. He ordered dinner. At 8:30, he had finished without having seen either Gonzalez or the two young men. He smoked several cigarettes. The restaurant was gradually emptying. Outside,
Night was falling rapidly. The curtains hung across the doorway were billowing in a warm breeze from the sea. At 9, Rombert realized that the restaurant was quite empty, and the waitress was eyeing him curiously. He paid, went out, and noticing that a cafe across the street was open, settled down there at a place from which he could keep an eye on the entrance of the restaurant. At 9:30, he walked slowly back to his hotel, racking his brains for some method of tracking down Gonzales, whose address he didn't know, and bitterly discouraged by the not unlikely prospect of having to start the tiresome business all over again. It was at this moment, as he walked in the dark streets along which ambulances were speeding, that it suddenly struck him, as he informed Dr. Ryu subsequently, that all this time he'd practically forgotten the woman he loved. So absorbed had he been in trying to find a rift in the walls that cut him off from her. But at the same moment, now that once more all ways of escape were sealed against him, he felt his longing for her blaze up again with a violence so sudden, so intense, that he started running to his hotel, as if to escape the burning pain that nonetheless pervaded him, racing like wildfire in his blood. Very early next day, however, he called on Ryu to ask him where he could find Kotar. "The only thing to do is to pick up the thread again where I dropped it." "Come tomorrow night," Ryu said. "Taru asked me to invite Kotar here. I don't know why. He's due to come at 10. Come at 10:30. When Kotar visited the doctor next day, Taru and Ryu were discussing the case of one of Ryu's patients who, against all expectation, had recovered. "It was 10-1 against," Taru commented. "He was in luck." "Oh, come now," Kotar said. "It can't have been plague, that's all." They assured him there was no doubt it was a case of plague. "That's impossible, since he recovered. You know as well as I do, once you have plague, your number's up." "True enough, as a general rule," Ryu replied. "But if you refuse to be beaten, you have some pleasant surprises." Kotar laughed. "Precious view, anyhow. You saw the number of deaths this evening?" Taru, who was gazing amiably at Kotar, said he knew the latest figures, and that the position was extremely serious. But what did that prove? Only that still more stringent measures should be applied. "How? You can't make more stringent ones than those we have now." "No, but every person in the town must apply them to himself." Kotar stared at him in a puzzled manner, and Taru went on to say that there were far too many slackers, that this plague was everybody's business, and everyone should do his duty. For instance, any able-bodied man was welcome in the sanitary squads. "That's an idea," said Kotar. "But it won't get you anywhere. The plague has the whip hand of you, and there's nothing to be done about it." "We shall know whether that's so," Taru's voice was carefully controlled, "only when we've tried everything." Meanwhile, Ryu had been sitting at his desk, copying out reports. Taru was still gazing at the little businessman, who was stirring uneasily in his chair. "Look here, Monsieur Kotar, why don't you join us?" Picking up his derby hat, Kotar rose from his chair with an offended expression. "It's not my job," he said. Then, with an air of bravado, he added,